Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Archer's Return by Martin Archer, narrated by Sean Grindell. Chapter 1. The Archer's Return. It was mid-April, and the Channel storms had subsided when I gave my son and my priestly brother a final big hug and issued the order for our galleys and cogs to cast off and head down the Foy and out into the Channel. We were going to make a dash to the coast of France before the weather changes again. It was quite a fleet we'd put together. We were sailing for the Holy Land with 12 of our 14 Cornwall-based galleys, and both of our large cargo-carrying single-masted cogs going out as pirate takers. They were carrying just over 1,000 of the sailors and archers we'd recruited and trained since we left the Holy Land a year ago. Almost every archer in our company was in the fleet. Only a handful of the veterans needed to train our new apprentice archers were being left behind in Cornwall. My basic plan was quite simple, as all good plans must be. Dash across the Channel to France when the weather is good, and then turn right and follow the French and Portuguese coasts through the Mediterranean to a rendezvous at Lisbon, and then at the port of Palma on the island of Majorca. From Palma, we'd sail on to Crete, where we'd rendezvous again, and from Crete we'd sail and row our way to Malta, perhaps to even set up some sort of a permanent base on the island, if its ruler, our old pirate friend Brindisi, would allow us to do so. Then it would be on to Cyprus to join the galleys and cogs we already have in the Holy Land. It was the reverse of the route we followed last year to get what was left of our original company of archers back to England. If all went exactly according to my plan, which wasn't at all likely if the past is any guide, our galleys would hug the coast and pick up water along the way at the little villages that are inevitably located at the mouth of the smaller rivers and streams running into the sea. The village people would often not be friendly and almost always hard to understand because they speak so many strange dialects, particularly when we reach that part of the Spanish coast where the villagers are mostly heathen Muslims. But no matter how they pray, there was little they could do to stop our war galleys from gathering water when we anchor at a river's mouth and begin dipping in our leather buckets. Our two cogs were carrying more water skins and water barrels than the galleys, so they'd be able to travel farther out and stop less frequently. Even so, they tend to follow as close to the coast as possible in an effort to attract pirates, because they were going out as pirate takers. And the Moorish pirate galleys tend to stay close to shore, so they can be pulled ashore on dry land if a storm approaches. Palma should once again be interesting, and as usual, a bit dicey, because it was a Moorish port, with a Muslim ruler where the Christians from Genoa and Pisa have concessions. So shall we one day, I hope, have our own concessions in Palma, I mean. My brother and I learnt a lot from all the mistakes we made, getting the survivors of our company of archers back to England from King Richard's crusade. That's why each and every galley and cog I was leading out to Cyprus and the Holy Land ports was sailing with at least two or three experienced pilots, a full crew of sailors, and highly trained archers, equipped with longbows and long-handled bladed pikes, and as many water skins and water barrels as it could carry in addition to its crew and supplies. On the other hand, some things won't be changed. Both of our cogs will be going out as pirate bait, with their archers and swordsmen hidden, until a pirate galley comes alongside and grapples them to hold them tight, whilst the pirates board. Hopefully the pirates will do so. Board, I mean, thinking they are about to take an unarmed cargo cog, and will soon have the cog and its cargo and its crew as slaves to sell. Slaves taken by the Muslims are important to the Muslims' Grand Caliph, or whatever their pope is calling himself these days. Selling them as how he was getting the coins he was using to pay for his war in Spain, against the Christians of Castile and Leon. Anyhow, that's what my brother Thomas says, and he's usually right, being as he's so well read and such. Pirate galleys are very much like ours. They tend to stay to closer into shore, so they can take on water and run up into the local streams and harbours for shelter when there is a storm at sea. They also like to throw grappling irons onto innocent apparent cargo cogs such as ours, and swarm aboard to take the cogs as prizes and their sailors as slaves. When a pirate galley comes alongside and its crew begins to board, our cog sailors will throw their own grapples to hold the pirate galley even tighter so it can't get away. That's when our cog's real cargoes, an entire company of English archers and other fighting men, our marine archers, as we've come to sometimes call those of our men who've been learnt to fight both on land and on the sea, will charge out from the cog's deck castles and holds where they've been hiding, and sweep the surprised and outnumbered pirates into the sea. At least, that was one of the things my brother and I intended for our cogs to do on their return voyage to the Holy Land. If it works, and it certainly has in the past, we'll be able to take some pirate galleys as prizes, and add them to those we are already using to carry pilgrims to the Holy Land, and then use them again to rescue the pilgrims when they become refugees and are willing to pay to get away from the heathen Saracens. Our archer-carrying cogs are quite special. There are a lot of galleys crewed by heathen pirates everywhere in the Mediterranean, and with a little luck, our pirate-taking cogs will attract some of them before we reach Palma. What Thomas and I haven't shared with any of our men is what I plan to have our galleys do after we reach Palma. It's a good plan, and will no doubt work perfectly, as all battle plans do in their makers' minds, until the fighting actually starts and everything changes. I was sailing on my lucky galley, the big one with 44 oars on each side, that carried George and me in our coin chests safely all the way back to England. Harold is once again the galley's sergeant-captain, and the master sergeant over all the sergeant-captains commanding our galleys and cogs. He is by far the best galley captain we've got, even if he can't read or scribe. Young Peter, the fast-thinking archer from the battle at Launceston, is coming with me as my helper and fetcher. I was initially going to leave Peter at Launceston to be second to Martin, the veteran archer who is steady but slow. In the end, I changed my mind and left a defrocked Italian priest, Angelo Priestley, to assist Martin, who is Launceston's constable, because Martin doesn't know how to read, and Thomas likes to send scribed messages. Thomas found the ex-priest and vouched for his honesty and ability to scribe and sum. It was obviously something personal that got him thrown out of the church and caused him to run. Whatever it was, Thomas seemed quite sympathetic and willing to ignore it. Our Palma-bound galley and cogs will try to stick together for as long as possible by hanging night lanterns on our masts. It'll be good practice for what we're going to try to do after we leave Palma. Sooner or later, of course, we'll be separated when the lanterns are lost from sight, or the weather changes and drives us apart. Then each galley will sail to Palma on its own. Sooner came fairly quickly. We were pretty much able to stay together until we left Lisbon. But within hours of leaving Lisbon Harbour, a big storm scattered us, and it was every galley and cog for itself, as we headed towards Gibraltar and the entrance to the Mediterranean, and the Moorish pirate galleys we hoped to meet. The seas were high, and the storm's gusting winds were blowing toward shore.
That wasn't much of a problem for our galleys, because they can row to keep ourselves offshore.
It was a big problem, however, for the cogs. Their crews had to constantly shift their sails about to keep from getting blown into the surf and rocks. What was a big problem for the galleys was the cold seawater that constantly leaks through their wooden hulls, and sometimes comes in over the bows in rough weather, because they sit so low to the water. We were, as the sailors like to say, all too often freezing our wet asses off, and having to constantly bail like galley slaves with our leather buckets. Also, although there wasn't anything I could do about it, I was increasingly worried about our two cogs. The wind was all wrong for them, and they didn't have oars to row themselves to safety if they got blown towards a dangerous shore. It's hard to believe, I know, but it's true. The wind can actually blow against a cog's mast and the side of the cog's hull sticking up out of the water, and they act as sails. That's what blew Richard's future queen and his sister ashore on Cyprus all those years ago, and caused us to go there with him to fight to rescue them, instead of going straight for the Holy Land and Jerusalem. Everyone, including me and Harold,
bailed and rowed in the storm for almost two cold and exhausting days. Then the weather suddenly cleared up, and we passed Gibraltar Castle, running before the wind with our leather sail up and our galley's stubby little mast, and periodically rowing once our rowers' arms got enough rest to recover their strength. The storm really did us in, at least it did for me, and I've got an archer's strong arms, so I can only imagine how the sailors and men-at-arms felt, who'd never pulled a bow in practice or for real. To everyone's surprise, we were not alone as we came out of the storm and into the clear weather beyond it. One of our cogs, the one with a big patch on his sail, captained by Albert, the archer sergeant from Devon, came up on us fast as we both came out of the storm at the same time. So fast, because of the favourable winds coming from the storm, that we had to row to keep up, so we could talk as we entered the Narrows and passed the big Gibraltar rock with a huge Moorish castle on its peak. I wonder why are there no more Moorish galleys here at the entrance to collect tolls and taxes and such? We'd have them here if we could take the rock. Harold managed to keep Albert Devon's cog in sight, and we were able to reach the harbour of Palma together 2 days later. To my absolute delight, our other cog was already at anchor in the harbour, and four of our galleys were moored to the quay. There were happy hails and waves all around as we entered the harbour and dropped our anchors. Within minutes, dinghies were rowing towards us to report in and share the latest news. Palma is on Mallorca Island. It's a beautiful place, and under the nominal control of some Moors from a tribe called Berbers, or something like that. What's good for us, and the reason we put in here for water and to reform our fleet so that we can sail out together, is that the Muslims are in the midst of another of their long-running and bloody civil wars. And Mallorca's Berber ruler is a deadly enemy of the Muslim Caliph, who rules Tunis and Algiers on the other side of the Mediterranean. The fighting between the Muslims may be bad for the local people and the merchants of Palma, but it was good for us, because the local heathens were keen to tell us everything they could about their equally heathen enemies on the other side of the sea, and they had a lot to tell us that might be useful. Whether what they tell us will be useful is always uncertain, but it certainly beats nothing. Information about your enemies is always important, isn't it? All in all, as we knew from our last visit, Palma was apparently a fairly civilized place, with many Christians and Jews living on the island as farmers and merchants. Genoa and Pisa have had commercial establishments here for many years. The tavern and the two alehouses next to the quay weren't bad either, just smoky when it got cold at night and their warming fires were lit. The tavern in particular has great bread and cheese, even though the girls smell bad. We'd come to Palma again to refresh our supplies and get information about the Moorish pirates, because we didn't have any problems when we called in here in the past, both when we rendezvoused here last year on our way to England, and again when our galley stopped here in September on their way back to Cyprus from England. Once again, it seemed to be the case, them being friendly, I mean. Indeed, the local Muslims said they were pleased that we'd given the Tunisians such a good poke in the eye last year. At least that's the story we got from the local merchants, both when we called in here last year and on this visit as well. The Genoan and Pisa merchants were another matter entirely. They were Christians, and very much like the island's Jewish and Muslim merchants, and merchants everywhere, all smiles and happy enough to take our coins in the marketplace and pay us to carry their cargoes. According to several of the Jewish merchants, however, the Genoans and Pisans were not at all happy to see us in Palma once again. They knew about our concession and trading posts on Cyprus and elsewhere. They feared we'd come here and set up to be their competitors for the Christian trade. And, of course, they're right to be worrying about us, because someday Thomas and I will indeed be establishing a shipping post here, if our plan succeeds. Unfortunately, the day for us to establish a post here would appear to be a long way off. So we'll do as we've done before, and go out of our way to convince the local Christians and everyone else that we are friendly, and merely passing through our way to the Holy Land to earn more coins carrying refugees and pilgrims. Of course we were acting friendly,
It isn't good for trade to scatter shite where you walk, and we almost certainly will want to stop here again as we come and go between Cornwall and Cyprus. Even so, the local Christians didn't trust us, and I didn't trust them, and rightly so. I also didn't trust the local Muslim ruler, because he's a Muslim. It's well known that they'll change sides in an instant and cut off your head if one of their priests tells them that's what God wants, or they start listening to one of their wives or mistresses. They're very much like our Christian kings and popes, aren't they? If we ever come here permanently, we'll probably have to take over the whole island and get rid of all the Muslims. Unfortunately, we're still a long way off from being strong enough to do it. Besides, we have other, more important, bread to bake.
"It's good to see everyone again," I told our captain's sergeants as they assembled on the deck of Harold's galley to report to me and him.
When all the captains in the harbour finished climbing on board, I gathered them around me on the deck to tell them the plan. But I'm only going to tell them a small part of it, and I do not want to wait for the sergeant captains of our missing galleys to arrive before we start spreading false rumours. I want to start spreading them as soon as possible.
"All right, lads, here's the plan. We'll be leaving here and rendezvousing in Malta as soon as the rest of our galleys arrive, and the weather looks good. In the meantime, you can give your crews short, 2-hour shore leaves during the daylight hours. Time to wet their whistles and dip their dingles. But only a few men at a time, and no one is to be allowed ashore after dark. I want you all to make sure your men understand why they must always stay close to their vessels and their weapons. Both because every cog and galley must always be ready to repel boarders, in case the Moors come with their galleys, and because, depending on the weather, we'll probably be leaving on short notice and heading for Malta. We'll leave on the first good weather, as soon as the rest of our galleys come through the harbour entrance and can take on the necessary water and supplies."
Young Peter Sargent looked confused after I finished speaking to the sergeant captains and sent them back in their dinghies to their galleys and cogs. He'd heard me asking our pilots what they knew about Algiers and watched intently during our voyage as I studied the two maps I'd bought off the mapmaker in Lisbon. Indeed, Peter had been with me when I bought the maps in Lisbon and sat there quietly whilst I spent an entire afternoon plying the mapmaker and his assistant with questions about Algiers and the pirates based there. He had expected to hear me say we'd be going to Algiers. I tried to explain things to Peter after the sergeant captains rowed away in their dinghies. I'm trying to learn him, aren't I? "Do you understand what I'm trying to do by telling the captain's sergeants we'll be heading for Malta from here, Peter?" "Of course you do. Or you will, if you think about it."
"Consider this," I told him quietly, so none of the crew around us could hear what I said. "Many of the people here on the island are Muslims, and they and all the merchants undoubtedly have dealings with the Algerians and all the other pirates, despite the war going on between their various rulers and priests. We want the word to get out to the merchants and taverns and churches about our plans to sail to Malta from here, because we're not going to Malta."
Chapter 2. The men learn of my plan. Our 12th and final galley rowed into Palmer's Harbour this morning, and Harold and the pilots agreed the weather looks promising. Accordingly, early in the afternoon, after a final visit to the harbour tavern for a bowl and a chop, I pissed in the harbour and ordered Peter to run up the flag, calling my sergeant captains to a meeting. They'd seen the last of our galleys come in earlier today, and my summons was expected. Within the minute, the sergeant captains were all in their dinghies and being rowed to where my galley was moored against the quay. Some of them were wearing their hooded leather tunics. It was chilly on the water, even though it was a beautiful spring day in early April. My message was short and sweet, and I winked at Peter after I said it.
"All our galleys are here now, and we'll be sailing for Malta in a few hours. So all of you must stop granting shore leaves to your men, and immediately send parties ashore to recall your leave men who are already there. We'll need all of our men for the trip, so I want all of you whose galleys are at the quay to immediately move them to the harbour and anchor them there, so our men can't run or slip ashore for one last drink or dingle dip. My galley will stay here at the quay and board those of your men who return from leave after you anchor in the harbour. I'll bring them out to you later. Dismissed.
3 hours later, and the flag went up again to call another meeting of the sergeant captains. Most of their shore parties and leave men had already returned, and all of our galleys were now anchored in the harbour and provisioned and ready to go. Harold had also moved our galley into the harbour, and this time the meeting was not short and sweet.
"Everyone, listen up," I said as I raised my hands for silence. "Here is information for your ears only, and not to be shared with any member of your crew until we clear the harbour. Our galleys are not going from here to Malta and then on to Cyprus. We're going to make a slight detour. As soon as the weather looks good, we are going to take our galley into Algiers looking for prizes, and then go on to Malta with any we take." There were cheers and smiles all around, and rightly so. Almost every man on the deck was on our raid into Tunis, and had profited greatly from it. And those who hadn't been to Tunis had certainly heard all about it. Then I continued with the best of all possible good news. This time the prize money would be even greater. "Prize money will be as follows. Sergeant captains will receive 3% gold coins for every galley or cog or other cargo transport their galley or its prize crews take and get to Malta. Sergeants who aren't on a prize crew, 3 silver coins. And every man 20 copper coins. Every man of every rank will also get another 2 coppers for each additional vessel his galley and its prize crews burn. And that's not all. Sergeants who become prize captains will get 2 gold coins and keep their prize as its sergeant captain if they get it to Malta. Their prize sergeants will get 9 silvers and their prize crewmen 60 coppers. Fishing boats and fishermen are to be left alone as always."
Yes, we're generous, but we're not dumb. Even the meanest galleys and cogs were worth much more than the prize money we'd be paying to get them, and burned galleys can't be used against us. Loud cheers and even bigger smiles were the order of the day when the captains heard the prize monies they'd receive for the prizes they take and burn. All but 2 of the sergeant captains were with us on our visit to Tunis last year, and what they are now being offered is a chance for advancement for their men, and riches beyond their dreams for themselves. There was, of course, the not-so-little matter of actually getting to Algiers, and actually taking prizes, and actually getting them to Malta. The only men not smiling were our 2 cog captains. They were not going to accompany us to Algiers, so I took great pains to console them. And rightly so, as I later explained to Peter Sargent. Albert from Devon, the captain of one of them, was one of the original archers and deserved to know he was not being slighted. And for that matter, so does William from Chester, who was the archer sergeant captaining the other cog. "Don't worry, you two. You and your men will get the very same prize money for every pirate galley or Saracen cargo vessel you take from this moment on. So you and your crews are likely to end up with more prize money than anyone else by the end of the sailing season. You can sail from here to anywhere you wish and begin baiting them to attack your cogs as soon as our galleys clear the harbour for Algiers. Send your prizes to Cyprus by whatever route sounds best. You and your men will collect your prize coins on the Limassol Quay, just like everyone else. Oh yes, and each and every one of you must make damn sure your prize sergeants and crews understand they'll need to have enough water in their skins, or a good plan as to where they'll get some on their way to Cyprus." Then we got down to seriously planning our raid, and arranging for the cogs to pass out the extra candle lanterns and incendiary bundles of dried twigs they'd been carrying as cargo, without even their sergeant captains knowing why. 2 days later, the weather looked good for reaching the harbour at Algiers during the Moor's special prayers, which, as everyone knows, start at noon on Friday. Friday being the Islamic Sabbath, and the day Muslims are most likely to be in their churches praying.
is what I've always been told whenever I ask the Muslim merchants we've encountered, and I devoutly hope it's true, for it is always best to try to steal something when his owner isn't around to try to stop you. It was crisp and clear, with winds from the north, when I ordered Peter Sargent to raise the Follow Me flag on Wednesday in the early afternoon, and then nodded to Harold. A few shouted orders from Harold, and the anchor of his big galley was raised, and his rowers were in their places. Everyone was obviously waiting for the signal and ready to go. A few seconds later, the sound of many rowing drums began to boom, and a long line of galleys followed us out of the Palma harbour. The men on our prize-taking cogs were crowding their rails and waving down to us and cheering as we rowed past them. I could see Albert Devon high above me on his cog, and we exchanged friendly salutes and waves as our galley passed by on its port side. The cogs were now free to be on their way to troll for pirates whenever their sergeant captains consider the wind and weather to be favourable. As soon as our galleys cleared the harbour entrance, they moved in and closed up tight around us. We'll stay close together all day, and when the sun finishes passing overhead, we'll use the light from the candle lamps on our masts in an effort to remain close together in tonight's darkness. Using their candle lamps was important, I'd explained to the sergeant captains, because we want our galleys to stay together so we can go into the Algiers harbour in one big group Friday morning. To push a heavy English arrow into the heart of the Moorish pirates was how I put it. According to all the information Harold and I have been able to gather, the Algerians are most likely at prayers when the sun is directly overhead on Fridays. According to Harold, and those who are supposed to know about such things, noon on Friday is when the Moorish galleys and cargo transports in the Algiers harbour are most likely to be empty of everyone except their slaves, and either moored or pulled up on the beach so they can't float away. Cutting out their galleys and transports whilst the pirates were praying worked for us at Tunis, and we were all hoping it will work for us again here at Algiers. Attacking when they're distracted by other things and least expect an attack is always the best policy when fighting Muslims and everyone else. The weather was favourable, and our brightly lit candle lanterns enabled us to stay together under the stars of mostly clear skies, both Wednesday and Thursday night. A couple of hours after sunup on Friday morning found us bobbing in the water just off the coast near Algiers, with our men fully rested and ready to go. Harold and I looked at each other, and we both nodded our heads.
"Hang the Follow Me flag and the attack flag on a mast," Harold bellowed at the chosen man he'd had standing at the ready at the mast ever since the sun came up. Harold and the other galley captains will be using their sails and having their men rowing easy to conserve their strength until we reach the harbour entrance. Harold and I watched with appreciation as our galley immediately, and very prematurely, formed into the attack formation we'll use when we pass through the harbour entrance. After a while, Peter fetched me my iron helmet and sword, and one of the small round shields hanging on the deck railing. I was already wearing my chain shirt, and had my longbow and quivers of arrows slung over my shoulder. Everyone was ready for a fight, including me. Peter and I both carrying our longbows and two quivers of iron-tipped arrows. Peter's got a small shield and sword as well, and a borrowed helmet which looks like it doesn't fit as well as mine. The other archers on board Harold's galley were similarly equipped. Whilst we watched, they untied and spread out on the deck all the many bales of arrows we have on board. Without a doubt, similar preparations were underway on every one of our galleys. Chapter 3. We visit Algiers. Algiers is a huge place with a superb natural harbour. It's an altogether impressive city, with a couple of beautiful white sandy beaches, and houses with red tile roofs running up from the city's long wooden stone quay to the city walls, and then beyond the walls on the far side of the city, all the way up to the great fortress crowning the hill, which towers above the city and its harbour. More than 20,000 people are said to live inside Algiers city walls, and as many again outside of them. And if half the stories I've been told are true,
They are all apparently either pirates or merchants, or their slaves and servants.
Our tightly...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?